to order the March 28th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. Members, we have a very full agenda today, so we are going to start right in. And the first thing we're going to take up is House Concurrent Resolution 11. I'll open a public hearing and work session on HCR 11. And Representative Bonamici is here to talk about it. Jim, would you like to tell us about it?
Yes, Chair Rosenbaum, HCR 11 memorializes Michael T. Muniz, 1952 to 2006, Immigration Law Authority.
Good morning, Representative, and welcome to the Elections and Ethics and Rules Committee. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Bonamici. I'm the representative for House District 34 in Washington County, and I'm the chief sponsor of HCR 11. First, I want to acknowledge Michael's wife, Lydia Muniz, who's with us today. She works as the governor's advocate for minority women and emerging small businesses.
And Representative Bonamici, excuse me for just a minute, but why don't we have Danny Santos, if he's here.
He is here, indeed.
And go ahead, please.
Thank you. And Danny Santos, the policy advisor for the governor, who will be speaking also. Michael was not my constituent. He was, in fact, Representative Thatcher's constituent, lived in Salem. But the reason I'm bringing this House Concurrent Memorial is because I knew Michael for years. I first met him in 1978 when he was a Reggie at the Lane County Legal Aid Office in Eugene, where I was working as a paralegal. Reggies are recipients of the Reginald Heber Smith Community Law Fellowship, which was named after the founder of Legal Aid. And they're people like Michael who were dedicated to public service and helping those less fortunate. And Michael spent the rest of his career doing just that. Michael Muniz earned his BA in political science from the University of California, Santa Barbara, in 1974, and his law degree from Lewis and Clark Law School in 1978. After working at Legal Aid in Eugene, Michael went on to other legal services programs, focusing his work on immigration, disability, farm worker rights, economic development, and senior issues. He later went into private practice and had offices in both Portland and Salem. He published several articles and became a highly respected speaker on immigration law. Following the lead of our mutual friend, former State Representative Rocky Berea, Michael went on to teach immigration law at both the University of Oregon Law School and at Lewis and Clark Law School. In 2005, the Oregon chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association honored Michael with the Gerald H. Robinson Excellence in Advocacy Award in recognition of his outstanding and tireless advocacy of immigrant rights. The September 29, 2006 issue of the Portland Business Journal published an article titled Immigration Law Boom. It was interesting. I was reading through that article over the weekend, and there were several quotes from Michael in there, especially about the article was about how attorneys were staying so busy with all the key immigration agencies and doing all the work that's required working with Department of Homeland Security and Customs Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Michael was quoted in the article expertly discussing how immigration law practice varies so much and is dependent on the actions of Congress. That article was published just one day before Michael's untimely passing, which was in September 30th of 2006. Michael was the kind of person who has had an amazing combination of intellect, charm, ethics beyond belief, optimism, empathy, and an unwavering dedication to helping his community and everyone living in it. And I can tell you, as somebody who worked with Michael, he brought such an incredible positive force to everyone he worked with. I didn't see Michael often after we worked together years ago, but I do know he was incredibly devoted and close to his family. I attended Michael's memorial service here in Salem. And when you have a combination of several hundred lawyers and an open microphone, you always wonder what's going to happen. But I tell you, it was incredibly moving to sit and listen to so many people, colleagues, friends, family, speaking from their hearts about how Michael changed the lives of so many people in a positive way. And to close, I want to tell a story that Michael's brother Matthew shared at the memorial service. A few years ago, Michael was in Portland working on a case. A young woman came up to him and said, "You don't remember me, but my family was your client when I was a little girl. You are the reason I'm an American now. I was so impressed with you that I decided I wanted to help other immigrant families, and because of you, I'm now in my third year of law school." Michael Moniz and his contributions to our state will be greatly missed. I urge you to join me in honoring the life and career of Michael Moniz by sending House Concurrent Resolution 11 to the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danny Santos. I do serve as a policy advisor for Governor Kulongowski, but my role here today is more as a friend and colleague of Michael Moniz. To speak in support of House Concurrent Resolution Number 11. It's my pleasure to say a few words. I won't read my testimony for you, but as Representative Bonamici mentioned, we are honored to have my colleague and friend Lydia Moniz here from the governor's office. And I want to say on behalf of Lydia and Michael's family, sincere thank you to Representative Bonamici for bringing forward House Concurrent Resolution Number 11. Besides being a loving husband, son, brother, and friend, Michael was indeed a very good lawyer, as was referenced earlier. But what distinguished Michael beyond being a normal lawyer was his compassion, his passion, his ability to get involved with a great deal of service to not just his clients, but his community and to the state. Michael was tireless in his commitment to service for Oregon, for his clients. I just want to read for you one paragraph from my testimony that came from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Paul de Munis. He was a wonderful human being. He was a person who walked his talk. He believed in service to man. He believed in service to community. And he believed in this legal aid service that he participated in for a good time. For Michael, being a lawyer was not a job. It was a calling. And those of us here recognize that, and we need to honor that always. I think one of the greatest compliments that could be paid to anyone is one that where not just your friends call upon you, but your colleagues on the opposing side, the people you actually work for call on you, seek out your counsel, and just lay people come to you and ask for your advice and counsel. And that was Michael, and he was always giving in that respect. I think Michael felt that he was a very lucky person and much had been given to him. I think those of us who knew Michael actually knew that he had worked very hard to get what he had earned. But from that, he came up with a great philosophy of giving back to the community. And some of the stories you heard here about not just his clients he served, but also his giving back to the community in many, many ways was a tremendous asset to this state. And I will share with you his willingness to contribute back to the community by emphasizing opportunities for young people, in particular, education. Michael and Lydia are founding members of a scholarship program called Scholarships for Oregon Latinos. And through that program, they provide resources so kids can go on to a post-secondary education. And I should say that the focus of that program is not necessarily the high flyers. Those students will naturally go on and do good things. We hope. And then the other thing of it is that what the concentration was on those people who didn't have the blessings of a family that had pioneered a post-secondary education, but who actually had worked throughout their lives to support their families, to feed their families, house their families. And this is a way that Michael and Lydia and others found that they could give back to the community. So, again, it was just one more piece of evidence that of Michael's giving back. And all of these things are just some of the examples of Michael's giving to communities, to the state. And again, whether it was serving those of the poorest of the poor or advising the highest levels of the state and actually the country, congressional delegations, Michael was there always giving. And for that reason, I would ask your support for House Concurrent Resolution Number 11 and ask that you support and honor Michael in this way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your testimony. He sounds like a very remarkable individual. Are there any questions for our witnesses? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
I just have a comment, I suppose. I just know Lydia, and if Michael is half as neat as she is, then he certainly deserves this recognition.
Thank you. Yes, and Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I have to comment because I know Lydia and I've known Michael all these years, and I was in on sort of the beginning of the scholarships for, in a peripheral way, for Oregon Latinos coming to Chemeketa originally, and I just have to say that it is a shame that we lost Michael so soon. His gifts were many, and his contributions were huge, and I'm honored to be part of moving this through our body.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair Rosenbaum and committee, I will also be submitting testimony from Bob Donaldson, who's a lawyer at Black Helterline in Portland, who was a former law partner of Michael Moniz. And Bob couldn't be here today, but we will be submitting something from him in writing. So
thank you. And I think the members have that written testimony already.
Terrific.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Members, we are in a work session.
Yeah.
And Vice Chair Berger?
Madam Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 11 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
Representative Berger has moved House Concurrent Resolution 11 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? Please call the roll.
President Roland?
Aye.
Thatcher?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Buckley?
Aye.
Excused.
Sarah.
Aye. Motion carries. House Concurrent Resolution 11 goes to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation, and we will ask Representative Bonamici to carry. Okay, I will close the public hearing and work session on HCR 11 and open a work session on House Bill 2084. Mr. Stembridge.
Chair Rosenbaum, House Bill 2084, this is the fourth time that you've considered this. We have bill that originally authorized the Secretary of State to set the election date for the United States presidential primary, not necessarily the third Tuesday in March. You have the -1 amendment that combines the March 2008 election date with the presidential primary at one time only for February 5th, 2008. And that you had a motion and you adopted that amendment last session. You also have, or even last time you met, the last meeting, you also have the fiscal analysis that is dated yesterday. Should be part of your packet. And it talks about the fiscal impact being, I see the number, $2.87 million, about two-thirds of the way down there.
Actually, what I'm looking at is the last sentence, which says the costs range from 2.3 to 2.8.
Yes.
Members, this fiscal then obviously would mean that this should be looked at by the Ways and Means Committee. It did not originally have a subsequent referral, but we can certainly request that one be added, and that is what I would suggest that we do. So, is there discussion on this? No. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair?
That's Chair Buckley.
I moved that Representative Estes appointed some amendments. We're not moving on the amendment right now.
We have already adopted the amendment earlier. We did that at our last meeting.
Chair. I move House Bill 2084 to Ways and Means.
As amended.
As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Buckley has moved House Bill 2084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that a subsequent referral to Ways and Means be added.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Process
Vice
question.
Chair Berger.
Does this mean that it would go through the floor with a due pass, or does it go directly to Ways and Means?
It goes, I believe, to the floor in order for that subsequent referral to be added. So I think this is Mr. Stembridge. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, this goes to the desk. Then it would go on to Ways and Means. It's you're just clarifying that the committee here is recommending a due pass when it gets to the floor.
And we have been in communication with the Speaker's office about this referral, and I think we have been assured that's what will happen to it. So, yes,
Madam Chair, I'm very bothered by this fiscal. I think this is a wonderful idea. We had good testimony about why we should do this. I think I'm comfortable with moving it to Ways and Means. I still think it's a good idea. But I also know that Ways and Means struggles with a lot of other costs and issues, and So I'm going to vote for the motion, but with great reservations around the cost of this, and hope that Ways and Means will find a way to balance this against other things that they have, and even perhaps find more creative ways to bring this fiscal down. I kind of in my own mind had a $2 million sort of limit on this, but I'm not on Ways and Means. I think that they have sort of the skill and the ability to work with this. I am bothered by the do pass in the motion, but the fact of the matter is I am supportive of this because with our vote by mail, I don't believe, as been stated, that we will be passed over in this presidential primary, and it is an incredibly important primary, and I would really like to have my vote count for once in my lifetime. I don't know what the value of that is in cost. The value in citizenship is enormous, and understanding that with our vote by mail system, our votes will be in the mail at the same time as a whole bunch of other important caucuses and whatnot are going on, I'm going to support the motion.
Thank you for your comments. Further discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Excused.
Roseland?
Aye.
Roger?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator
Buckley? Aye. Chair Robinson? Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2084 goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that a subsequent referral to Ways and Means be added. I will close the work session on House Bill 2084. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3325. Mr. Sembridge, could you please tell us about this bill as we're waiting for the sign-up sheet here?
House Bill 3325 enters Oregon into an interstate compact to elect the president by national popular vote, with the compact taking effect only when states cumulative possessing a clear majority of electoral votes, that would be 270 electoral votes, have enacted the agreement. Once the compact is in effect, it requires Oregon's electoral votes to be cast for the presidential candidate receiving the highest national popular vote, regardless of which candidate has the highest number of votes in Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And we are in a public hearing. We have one witness signed up to testify. I see him at the podium. Dr. Koza, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. This is about electing the president.
Please identify yourself for the record.
John Koza, K-O-Z-A. This bill is about electing the president of the United States by a vote of the people in all 50 states, where every person's vote is equal. And it's described in our short 600-page book and also in Jim's somewhat shorter memo. This bill has 266 sponsors in 47 states, and so far it's passed the Arkansas House this year, the Hawaii Senate, the Colorado Senate, and on Monday, 3114, the Maryland Senate probably passed third reading today in Maryland. Oregon, like 47 other states, uses the so-called winner-take-all rule. That is, you award all of your electoral votes to the presidential candidate who gets the most votes inside the state. And that rule has very significant consequences. The first one is that it is possible to become elected president of the United States with fewer popular votes nationwide than another candidate. And that's happened four times. But it's almost happened five out of the last 12 presidential elections. If 60,000 votes had switched in Ohio in 2004, Kerry would have become president, even though he would have still been behind 3.5 million votes. Less than 10,000 votes in 1976 would have defeated Carter, even though he was ahead almost 2 million votes. Nixon in 68, one state, small change, would have wiped out his 0.5 million vote popular vote margin and elected Humphrey. And something similar in 48 and some of the other elections. So what we have is a random slot machine that produces the results whenever the election is contested. But the more serious shortcoming of the winner-take-all rule is that a presidential candidate has no incentive to campaign in two-thirds of the states, because it's perfectly clear in August that certain states can't be won by a given candidate and can't possibly be lost. So that the campaign shrinks down to a small number of battleground states. Most people don't realize how concentrated it is. Two-thirds of the candidate's visits and two-thirds of the money goes into just six states. 80% goes into nine states, and 99% of the money goes into only 16 states. So basically, two-thirds of the states, including your state, is left out of the presidential election process simply because your voters happen to be more than 54% or one way or the other. Our bill is an interstate compact. It has two clauses. The first is it does not take effect until states having a majority of the electoral votes pass the identical law. So it would have no effect, for example, on 2008. But we are hoping it will be in effect by 2012. And the second clause is that it would award your electoral votes, because you would then be part of a pool of 270 or more electoral votes where the legislatures would have committed in advance to the candidates and the people that the candidate who gets the most votes in all 50 states would win. So at that point, the Electoral College would be converted from a rubber stamp from the state-by-state counts in 48 states, and by the way, the district-by-district counts in Maine and Nebraska. It would be converted into a rubber stamp for the entire population's vote in the United States. In other words, a nationwide popular vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness? Representative Thatcher.
What are the arguments you've heard against this particular idea?
Madam Chairman, Representative Thatcher, there are a number. Some people, for example, in the really small states, like Hawaii, raise the issue that they get a little more oomph, they think, because each state gets two extra electoral votes. That would be less applicable here because you're a more medium-sized state. It was not the prevailing view in Hawaii, but that's an argument we do hear all the time. Our counter is that the 12 smallest states have 11 million people, and they have 40 electoral votes because of this bonus. Ohio has 11 million people. It has only 20 electoral votes. But as you well know, Ohio's at the center of attention in presidential campaigns with its mere 20 electoral votes, and the 12 smallest states are completely ignored in presidential candidates, even though they have 40. So we think that argument is an interesting one, but we think it doesn't it reflects arithmetic correctly, but it doesn't reflect the political reality that clout in a presidential election comes from being one of those delicately balanced 49-51 places, not from how many electoral votes you have.
How would you handle a recount if it was really close? Would you have a whole national election all over again, or what would you do?
Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher, first of all, recount would be less likely under a national vote. Right now, we get these close situations like the Tilden Hayes election, where five states were within 1,000 votes, and nobody knew where the electoral vote was. We get that because the vote is cobbled up into 51 separate counts, so it would be less likely. If it occurred, recounts could happen. State law, every Secretary of State is ready to conduct a recount in any part or all of his state after every election. There could be a recount in places where there was some legitimate issue. But recounts would be less likely when you have a single pool of 120 million instead of 51 separate pools of roughly 2 million each.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, just a question. Did I read correctly that the governor of California has endorsed this idea?
No, he vetoed this bill last year. We wish we had gotten to see him, but there were 1,000 bills on his desk, and we hope to see him this year.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you very
much
for
your
testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3325? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3325. And I will open a work session on House Joint Resolution 14. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, HGR 14 is a referral to the voters upon approval at the May 2008 primary election amends the Oregon Constitution to eliminate the double majority requirement for local property tax measures in the May and November elections. You have distributed to you First Amendment HJR 14-1 amendment, which changes the election date from the primary to the next general, so it would be November 2008.
And we held a public hearing on this on March 26th.
You did.
Okay, members, we are in a work session. Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendments, HJR 14.
Representative Hunt moves the -1 amendments to HJR 14. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment is adopted. Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I move the that we forward HGR 14 to the House with a due adopt, HGR 14 as amended with a due adopt.
Recommendation?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Hunt moves HJR 14 as amended to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Thatcher.
I think this is a pretty moderate proposal, but I am going to be opposing it just because I think there has to be some dissent on the committee, and I don't want to carry it. Another thing. But
now I get it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think amongst all the proposals out there for eliminating the double majority in some form or another, this one's probably the best one. So, but just putting that on the record.
Thanks. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a good resolution. I think it's high time we discuss this issue. I guess it's high time that we quit rewarding people that don't participate. That's where I'm at with it.
Thank you. And Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I supported a similar proposal last session. Because I think it is reasonable, and because, like Representative Esquivel, I'm very bothered by non-voters having a sort of an impact. I would also add that this is timely also in terms of the crisis that our counties may well be facing in terms of county services with the federal legislation that's on again, off again, but I think we all know it's going to go away soon. So for all those reasons, I support this resolution.
And Representative Hunt.
I thank you, Madam Chair. I do agree this is going to respond not only to, I mean, those timber-dependent counties facing crises, but it's really one of the few things we can do, I think, for local governments, whether it's schools, fire districts, counties, cities, veteran services. All kinds of local governments and service districts will have an opportunity, actually, to put measures out and to have a majority make decisions, which is a very good thing. I did also want to note in one of the pieces of testimony there was a question about whether the kind of the what appears to be a double notwithstanding clause made any sense in there. We did share with legislative council they are willing to come down and testify if you would like, but they said they did intentionally put that in there, and the way they read it was, I'm not a lawyer, but they said they looked at it again and they said that is the proper way it should be written. So I just wanted to let you know we did follow up on that.
Right.
Lawyer in language.
Representative Roplin.
Thank you very much. You know, from my perspective, I would really like to see it go away, all elections, but I think we do have to compromise, and I think what Representative Thatcher said is true, that this is a bill that a lot of people have looked at, and it's going to give you know, three or more elections every 2 years for people in local communities to make decisions that the majority can decide on. And I agree with Representative Esquivel that, you know, we can't continue to reward apathy. So
I'm going to go there. Thank you for your comment. And just to mention again that this is a referral to voters. Members, we did have an excellent hearing on this. We did not have one single person get up and oppose it, even though we were requesting testimony from opponents if there was any. I think that voters deserve a chance to take a look at it. It's a modest proposal. I'm very glad that we will be able to move it to the floor. The motion is to send it to the floor as amended. With the do-adopt recommendation, will you please call the roll?
President
Hunt?
Aye.
President Berger?
Aye.
President
Berger?
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hunt, would you like to carry this?
I would be happy to. I'd hope Representative Thatcher would carry it, but I'll carry it in her absence.
Okay, and I will close the work session on House Joint Resolution 14. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3040. Mr. Stembridge.
Chair Rosenbaum, House Bill 3040 directs that partisan office candidates be listed more than once on general election ballots. Once for each nomination received by the candidate, that allows candidates to decline to be listed as nominee of a specific political party. It directs that multiple votes for the same candidate on a single ballot be counted as a single vote for that candidate. Madam Chair, this has become known as fusion voting.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And colleagues, we have a lot of people here to testify on this bill. And I will just tell the audience a few things about the way we operate here. It's our standard protocol to allow people who have traveled from a great distance to testify first. And we do also have a telephone witness who I think is planning to testify at, if I'm certain.
Well, we suggested 9:30, but I think the person's probably listening, and we could call any time.
Okay, so we'll try to do that around 9:30. And so we'll start with some witnesses who have traveled from a distance, and that would be Adam Morse, Josh Mason, and Ben Healy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Elections Committee. And please go ahead.
I'll start, Madam Chair, distinguished members of the legislature. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Josh Mason. I work for the National Open Ballot Project, which is a small nonprofit devoted to educating legislators, citizens, and opinion makers about election reform and, in particular, about fusion voting. Fusion, which is also known as open ballot voting, is a simple reform that gives candidates for elected office the freedom to run with the endorsement of more than one political party. Throughout the 19th century, fusion was used in nearly every state of the Union, including Oregon, where multiple legislators and at least one governor were elected through fusion, particularly in the years around the turn of the century, around 1900. Today, fusion, unfortunately, is legal in only 7 states and commonly used in only New York, Connecticut, and more recently in South Carolina. But as voter participation drops, more and more citizens feel disconnected from the political process. Far-sighted legislators around the country are turning towards fusion legislation as a way to reinvigorate elections. As the member of the committee here described it, fusion is straightforward. It allows candidates to run with the nomination of multiple parties, with being listed on the ballot once for each party that has nominated them, and thereby gives voters the freedom to choose both a candidate and a party. And in my written testimony here, I've attached a couple of fusion ballots so you can see what they typically look like. There are several advantages to this this reform. First of all, it makes for a more informative ballot. Second, it gives a voice to citizens who may feel alienated from the two major parties. And third, it solves the spoiler problem that we face in our current system. So first, in terms of a more informative ballot, we find often, especially in down-ballot races, that voters don't necessarily know where the candidates stand, particularly voters who are concerned about issues that may cut across party lines. With fusion, a candidate may have a major party endorsement, will typically have a major party endorsement, just as they do today, but they may also have one or more minor party lines, which will clarify what their positions are and allow them to cast a more informed vote. Obviously, other types of endorsements can carry that same information, but the endorsement right on the ballot is accessible to every voter in a way that other endorsements are not. Second, there are a significant number of voters who feel alienated from the two major parties. In many elections, 5%, sometimes even 10% of voters choose a minor party instead of the Democrats or Republicans. And national surveys show that 50% of Americans have at some point or another cast a vote for a minor party. And yet all those voters' votes today are effectively wasted. They don't help elect candidates. They don't influence policy. Now, as we all know, disenfranchising someone is one of the most serious things you can do in a democracy, and yet effectively we disenfranchise millions of voters in the way that we handle minor party votes in this country. Some we disenfranchise just once, some occasionally, some nearly every time they go to the polls. This isn't just a loss for those people who choose to vote for minor parties, but also for our political system, because many of these minor party supporters are highly motivated, engaged, they have valuable ideas that would enrich our political life. By allowing minor parties to support candidates who actually have a chance of winning election, we can bring these active, engaged citizens into our political process instead of leaving them on the margins where their votes effectively have no impact. Finally, in the worst case, minor parties can act as spoilers, allowing a candidate to win even when they are opposed by the majority of the electorate. And we all are familiar with the case of 2000, but there are numerous elections where you find that minor parties, the role of the minor party is in effect to help the candidate who most of that party supporters would have opposed to win election. Fusion solves this problem by allowing minor parties to actually support the candidate, major party candidate, closest to their views, and therefore makes it much more likely that a winning candidate will actually be supported by a majority of the electorate. If it's all right, I'd like to take a couple minutes just to describe our experience with Fusion elsewhere in the country, particularly in New York. What we found is that the voters who are most attracted to Fusion ballots and to minor party lines are the young, the less educated new citizens and other groups of voters whose normal rates of voter participation are low. So this makes us believe that in general you should expect a Fusion reform to increase voter participation. It also suggests that when a minor party endorses a major party candidate, they aren't simply taking voters away from the major party line, but are bringing new voters in who might have voted for a third party otherwise or might well have simply stayed home. For instance, one recent study of judicial races in New York found that when a major party candidate also ran with a minor party line, they actually received, on average, more votes on their major party line in addition to the minor party votes. So it seemed as though some voters were looking for that minor party as a seal of approval, which they would then use to guide their vote on the Democratic or Republican line. Another example of that, in 2005, Pace University did a survey of New York City Democrats, asking them what endorsements had the greatest impact of their vote, looking at major newspapers, labor unions, environmental groups, women's groups, prominent politicians. The number one single most important endorsement among the respondents to the survey was the Working Families Party, a minor party that uses Fusion to cross-endorse members of the two major parties. The Independence Party, another Fusion party, also ranked highly. Now, these, again, are Democratic voters, many of whom probably vote typically on the Democratic line, and yet for them, the additional information provided by a minor party endorsement was evidently the most valuable information they could get about a candidate's positions. Even more interesting, in the same poll, the voters who were most responsive, who found who reported that they were most influenced by minor party endorsement, were first of all Latinos, secondly, younger voters, and thirdly, lower-income voters, all groups whose turnout is relatively low and who may be less firmly attached to the political process and to the two major parties. So again, this is clear evidence that what Fusion does is, by providing additional information and additional options on the ballot, it engages people in the political process who right now may not be engaged or who may be only sporadically engaged. And we've done a number of other surveys and seen surveys done elsewhere that suggest the same thing. And bringing these new voters into the process has a real impact. It actually can change. It can change outcomes in elections. It can change outcomes in the legislature. To go back a few years, John F. Kennedy would not have won New York's electoral votes for president, and therefore would not have won the presidency without the support of the Liberal Party, which was at that time a fusion party in New York. More recently, George Pataki would not have been elected governor without the support of the Conservative Party, which cross-endorsed him along with the Republicans. And most recently, New York State almost certainly would not have followed Oregon's example and raised its minimum wage without support from the Working Families Party for legislators of both major parties who supported a minimum wage increase. So what you can see from those three examples is there are times that Fusion ballots can help the political liberals or the political left. There are times when they can help the right, and there are times when they help the middle. But they almost always strengthen democracy by creating a more informed electorate, by engaging new people in the political process, and by eliminating or at least greatly reducing the danger of spoiling. It's not, you know, fixed all the problems with our elections. There's a lot of other reforms that are needed, but this is a simple, time-tested, long-established, practical American route to produce a more informed, engaged electorate. It gives a voice to citizens who are currently left out of politics, and it, as I say, it largely eliminates the spoiler danger. For all those reasons, I strongly encourage the Oregon legislature to move forward with this bill and to restore Fusion voting. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll have the whole panel before we have questions, so please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Adam Morse of Jenner and Block, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. The Brennan Center is a nonprofit organization dedicated to creating a more effective and inclusive democracy. I'm the principal author of the Brennan Center report on fusion that I'm submitting with this testimony, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 3040 to legalize fusion. I want to highlight three ways in which legalization of fusion voting will improve the functioning of elections. First, fusion mobilizes additional voters and increases turnout. Second, fusion reduces the so-called spoiler problem that third parties can create without fusion while allowing citizens who support a minor party to participate constructively in politics. Third, fusion provides voters and their representatives with additional information on crucial issues of the day, strengthening the core lawmaking function of a representative body like this one. I'll take these three points in turn. Low voter turnout is a chronic problem in American democracy. It makes our government less representative of the actual views and desires of the people and undercuts the connection democracy creates between the people and their government. It also skews the results of elections because certain groups, such as the poor and the young, fail to vote disproportionately often. Fusion increases turnout and encourages more of the population to participate in elections and in civic life in general. One of the reasons why some citizens choose not to vote is because of a belief that neither major party represents their views well enough, while voting for a third party would be throwing away their vote on a candidate with no meaningful chance of winning. Fusion solves that problem. A voter can cast a meaningful vote for a candidate with a credible chance of victory while still expressing their support for a third party's agenda. By giving a constructive role to third parties, fusion can also encourage additional organization that will further mobilize voters. Most states banned fusion in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as part of a deliberate effort to demobilize voters. This was part of a broader set of changes in election law that were designed to systematically reduce the electorate. Perhaps the most famous such change was the introduction of relatively cumbersome voter registration requirements, aimed mostly at reducing the ability of immigrants to become voters. Because of these deliberately burdensome barriers to participation, voter participation remains uniquely low in the United States. In many elections, a majority of the eligible voters do not vote. The bans on fusion voting that were introduced at the same time as the better-known voter registration rules also contributed to suppressing voter participation. In the North, fusion was banned in various state legislatures, largely through the efforts of the Republican Party, which wanted to prevent any alliance between Democrats and populists. In the South, meanwhile, it was just the reverse. Fusion was banned there by the Democratic Party, which wanted to prevent the reverse alliance between Republicans and populists. In both regions, the point was to prevent some citizens from voting at all. By and large, they succeeded in their goal. Banning fusion caused a substantial immediate decline in voter turnout. If the reinstatement of fusion voting increases turnout, even by a percentage point or two, you've made a useful contribution to the democratic process. A second advantage of fusion is that it provides a way for citizens who are supportive of a minor party to participate more constructively. We should recall that third parties can play a valuable function in our two-party system. They give a voice to citizens who feel that the major parties do not represent them, and can also raise issues and bring new ideas into policy debates that the major parties have been neglecting. Some very good ideas, the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, the eight-hour day, to name just a few, started as the ideas of third parties and were then adopted by the major parties. Without fusion, however, citizens who back third parties face a difficult, even insurmountable, dilemma. Because the candidates of minor parties very rarely win elections, a supporter of a minor party platform does little more than cast a protest vote by voting for a minor party candidate. What's more, third-party supporters run the risk of spoiling an election, producing a perverse result where a candidate who is opposed by the majority of the voters can still win. Fusion significantly reduces the dangers of spoilers by allowing voters who want to send a signal by voting on a third-party line to still cast a meaningful vote for a major party candidate. You might think of it as a way to allow a citizen to cast a message vote that counts. These votes for a candidate who is a nominee of both a minor and minor party can produce the best of all worlds for minor party supporters, allowing them to express their values in support of a candidate who has a meaningful chance of winning without any danger of spoiling. Fusion will not undermine the basic two-party system. In New York, where fusion has been actively used for 90 years and minor parties have used and continue to use fusion, the Republicans and Democrats remain the dominant parties. The same is true in Connecticut and South Carolina, two other states where fusion candidacies have occasionally flourished. But fusion does allow the people who support minor parties to play a more active and productive role in political life without the negative spoiler or wasted vote problems. Finally, fusion gives voters another tool to get action on specific goals and to cast an expressive vote. If a minor party focuses its energy on winning votes for a major party candidate with a message that says, vote for so-and-so and send her a message about health care, that will help both the voters and their elected officials. These voters will have the opportunity to better communicate their priorities through the ballot box. And it also helps the legislature better represent the people because it gives them more information about what the voters want and expect. Because legalizing fusion is an easy, straightforward way to improve elections and provide better representation to more of the people, the Brennan Center for Justice urges you to pass House Bill 3040. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and I believe we're holding questions till the whole panel has completed, so please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ben Healy, and first let me say, I hope you don't take offense that I'm not as well dressed as my colleagues. There's a very nice pinstripe suit somewhere between Boston and here. If anyone sees it. My testimony actually best follows an introduction from former Secretary Rappaport, so I leave it to you. I'm happy to give it now and then call him, or if you would prefer, try and get him on the phone right now, given that I am somewhat representing DEMOS and the Public Policy Institute in the consideration of technical issues and costs.
I think we're going to call him after this panel, so why don't you go ahead?
Fair enough. So I came in last night from Boston, where the Public Policy Institute is based, a nonpartisan public policy.
Chair, this microphone is very sensitive, so
I can move it back.
Yeah, move it back. You'll actually be heard better.
That's better.
How do I sound now?
Yeah. Better.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Very good. It's a nonpartisan public policy research and advocacy organization. And as part of our partnership with DEMOS, I served as the lead researcher on a briefing report that I believe you have in front of you, which simply addresses technical considerations and costs relating to fusion. So it talks somewhat about the good government arguments, but I'll be very brief on this. We spoke to officials in New York, South Carolina, and Connecticut. The brief report is, the New York Director of Election Operations said, this requires no more work on the part of local or state election agencies. In Connecticut, the Managing Attorney for the Legislation and Elections Administration Division at the Secretary of State's office said that fusion voting did not cause any additional cost or hardship in any municipality. It's important to note that in Connecticut, this was during a transition where they're piloting under HAVA, new optical scan voting machines, which I believe are in use widely here, or perhaps universally, and neither the old Lever machines or in the new optical scan voting machines was this problematic for Connecticut. In South Carolina, fusion had rarely been used until last year when five candidates ran with two-party endorsements. We talked to the State Elections Commission, and they said, again, there was no additional cost or difficulty in counting votes. Now, one of the concerns we've heard articulated in many places is, well, if voters see a candidate's name on the ballot twice, won't they be confused? Vote for them twice. Isn't this a problem? How do we deal with this? Is this a consideration either from a technical perspective or a cost perspective? In each of the three states, it's amazing to me as the researcher how much I was scoffed at asking this question. They said, well, it happens every once in a while, but it's no big deal, and we have things in place to deal with it. I was actually consistently surprised in conversations how matter-of-fact elections officials in these states were about fusion voting. They didn't think it was odd in any way, and even in South Carolina, where it had come back into effect after being fairly underutilized, there were no reports of complaints or problems. In New York, a ballot that has two votes for the same candidate gets recorded as a vote for the candidate, still counts as a candidate, but not with a party affiliation listed. In Connecticut, the Secretary of State instructed the clerks to count double votes as votes for candidates under the minor party, much to the surprise of the minor parties in Connecticut. But the assumption was, if the voter took the time to vote on the minor party line, that's probably what they meant to do, because otherwise why wouldn't they just vote for the Democrat or Republican? Who knows? In South Carolina, the machines they use don't actually even prevent double votes. And it's also useful here just to quote briefly the provider through much of the Northeast of a lot of the optical scan voting machines, a company called LHS Associates. I talked to the president at length about this, and he said to me, I think he thought I was doubting his credibility as an optical scan voting designer or something, but he said, Ben, the way the system is designed, the way the software is written, the individual only gets one vote. Using the technology we have, double voting is not a problem. There's some concerns we hear about whether or not upgrading machines is necessary. Obviously, Oregon uses optical scan voting machines already. Fusion is used under optical scan voting machines elsewhere. No, there's no fiscal implications there. Specifically, costs relating to ballot design, printing ballots, tallying votes, programming machines. We had extensive conversations both with LHS Associates and with vendors in other states. But I'm going to quote just again from this conversation I had with John Silvestro, the president there, who said that, yes, if you have a Fusion candidacy and there's another line on the ballot, for them, that's a $7.50 cost per election. So that's not that much in the first place. But he said it's no different, in fact, than if you had a third party who was running a candidate. The cost is associated with the line on the ballot, not with whether or not it's Fusion. Having said that, that's in fact the bulk of what I wanted to communicate, that in both technical considerations and costs, this is essentially a neutral reform that does not add a burden to clerks or election officials, nor does it have a fiscal impact of any meaningful level. So on behalf of the Public Policy Institute, and I'll let Miles Rappaport of DeMos speak for himself, but I'll say that on behalf of him as well, we urge the committee to support House Bill 3040 and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Are there any questions for this panel? Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, whichever one of you wants to take it. In House Bill 3040 on page 2, lines 23 through 28, it talks about the candidate's responsibility to step out of the nomination from a party if that candidate so chooses to do so. Is this consistent, to your knowledge, with how Fusion works in other states, where it's a candidate's responsibility to say, I've been given the backing of the independent party, and I decline to take the nomination?
It's largely consistent. The precise mechanism varies from state to state. In some states, that would be handled by the filing papers that the candidate files would need to specify that. The basic principle here is just that nobody should be required to carry a party banner that they don't support. And so it's important that any candidate have the ability to opt out, so that the only cases where fusion happens are where both the voters of the minor party and the candidate want to carry both the minor party and the major party label. I don't think this would create any substantial burden, and it just means that the candidate can control what parties the candidate is associated with.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a bunch of questions, but I was going to ask Oregon-specific questions, and then it occurred to me that you're not from Oregon, so I won't bother with those.
We have those folks coming.
Right. I think I'll just
remember
that. Hey, are any of the states that are doing this also using instant runoff voting?
I think the answer is no.
I believe that the answer is no. In general, instant runoff voting is currently not being used much. There are some municipalities that use it. I know that there's a instant runoff bill under consideration here, but that would only apply in nonpartisan elections, whereas I believe...
Cities and counties is my understanding, and that not all of those are nonpartisan.
That's correct. My understanding was that the city and county elections were nonpartisan, but...
Oh, I'm sorry, could you repeat your name for the record?
Oh, Adam Morse.
Thanks.
There's nothing incompatible with the two systems. There won't there wouldn't be any problem created by them both being in place. But I'm not aware of examples where they currently are.
I just actually
remember. Please identify yourself.
Oh, sorry, Josh Mason. I just remembered there is one case which is Vermont. I believe Burlington, Vermont. Now Vermont does not use the form of fusion that we recommend. They use a form of fusion where the candidate is listed a single time on the ballot with all their party affiliations listed after their name. We think that's less effective in achieving the goals of this reform than one where the candidate is listed multiple times, basically because it doesn't allow the voter to indicate which party they're voting for. So it doesn't engage voters or provide the type of information. But it is a form of fusion, and Burlington uses both that form of fusion and instant runoff voting. As Adam says, they're really different. They're orthogonal reforms. They address different aspects of the election process, and there's no reason you can't adopt both. They don't really interact or conflict with each other.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I heard you say a couple. I guess maybe I just need some clarification. You say you get only one vote. So if the Pacific Green Party nominates me and the Republican Party nominates me, I'm not saying I'm winning as a Pacific Green person. I'm just winning.
That's right. That's correct.
So what's the message?
Well, the message is that the number of votes are counted separately, are tallied separately on each line. Even though it's true that you will win, first of all, if you get 10%, 20% of your vote on the Pacific Green line, you have more information about who's actually voting for you and which voters you need to keep happy. Second, those people who are voting on the Pacific Green line, some of them may like you, but be reluctant, unwilling to vote for you as a Republican. They may have hostile feelings towards the Republican Party, so those people, many of them will vote for you who would not. And you say this sounds speculative, but in fact, as I say, what we've seen in states that use fusion is that, in fact, there are people who will vote for a candidate on a minor party line who would not have voted for that same candidate on a major party line.
Just to clarify, uh-huh. Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So you are counting how many are nominated. Okay, that's what I wasn't
right.
clear about.
Right, so the result, the election result would say
okay.
something
that's
like,
what I wanted to
know. Thatcher, 10,000 Republican, 2,000 Pacific Green,
okay.
and then 12,000 would be your total for determining the outcome.
That would be the extra information we're talking about. Okay, thank you. I wasn't clear on that.
Okay, thank you. And I wanted to ask any of you if you see any unique problems posed by our vote-by-mail system here in Oregon.
Ben Healy. In the course of doing this research, we were considering the problem of voter education around this issue. Does it require a great deal of explanation? And in fact, we think the vote-by-mail system, this is the conclusion we reached sort of talking amongst the research team and not necessarily in conversation with county clerks here. Take that as you will. Was that in fact it would be even easier to do the amount of voter education that you need to do by simply inserting sort of the postcard that says the bill was adopted, this is what it allows you to do, and it's right there on the ballot. And in fact, there shouldn't be any reason that it would provide.
And we'll be hearing from the county clerks shortly. So
very good.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I think next we will get our long-distance witness on the telephone. That is Miles Rappaport, who is in New York.
He's a very good-looking man.
Yeah. Well, he's calling.
Does he wear pinstripes on the phone?
Pinstripes. Oh, pinstripes.
Vice Chair Berger?
I just like to say to Representative Thatcher, I hope she's not counting on that Pacific Green vote.
You know. I thought we were learning not to at this hearing.
Sorry, Rep.
Yes, is Mr. Rappaport available, please?
Is this Jim?
This is Jim.
Hi, I'll put you right through. Hold on.
I thought that was a great show of bipartisanship.
There you go.
Good morning. Or good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, this is Representative Diane Rosenbaum, Chair of the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee in Oregon. Is this Miles?
Miles Rappaport. Hello, Diane.
Hi, good to hear your voice, and good afternoon, good morning here in Oregon. And we are ready to take your testimonies.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, I'm ready to give it.
Good. So please go ahead, identify yourself. And we do have your written testimony already. So.
Okay, wonderful. All right, so I guess I'm in a way testifying in two capacities here on behalf of House Bill 3040. First is that I'm currently the president of DEMOS, a network for ideas and action. And we are an organization, a policy, research, and advocacy organization based in New York. And one of the major program areas that we have is to look at election reform. And our perspective is that we ought to try to do things that open up the process as much as possible so that people can have an easier time voting, less barriers to participation, and I think the most choices possible so that we have the widest kind of conversation in our democracy possible. Secondly, though, I have had a fair amount of election experience myself. I was a member of the Connecticut House of Representatives from 1980. I was elected in 1984. I served for 10 years, 1985 to 1994. And during that whole time, I was a member of the Government Administration and Elections Committee and served for 2 years as chair of the committee. Then I was elected Secretary of the State and served a four-year term as Secretary of the State. So I've done a lot of election administration work and had a lot of opportunity to discuss both fusion voting as well as other reforms. I guess I'd add a personal note, and I mentioned this in my written testimony as well. We actually went through a period where there was when I was in the Connecticut legislature and when I ran for Secretary of the State, where there was a very active third party called a Connecticut party, and I was a cross-endorsed, we use the term in Connecticut actually, of cross-endorsed, but I was a fusion candidate. And both in terms of the campaign and in terms of the administration of the campaign and the counting of the votes in the campaign, there really wasn't any problem, despite the fact, in fact, that there was, in my Secretary of the State's race, a recount. So it was a closely watched and closely contested race. So based on all that, and based on my Connecticut experience and on the research work that we did here at DEMOS, I guess I really want to make three points about the fusion voting. One is I do think that it is a healthy reform for our democracy, I think particularly now. I mean, we live in a moment in history where, happily, I would say, there's an increase in voter engagement, voter involvement, contested elections. There's an interest in politics that we... I don't want to say that we haven't seen, but it seems to be increasing, especially among young people, especially among people who are coming into the process for the first time. That will inevitably, it seems to me, result in political candidacies, independent candidacies, political formations, even new political parties, potentially in Oregon, but in many other places, that will in one way or another express themselves in the political process. And it seems to me that one of the things that fusion voting can do is to allow that that energy and that choice in our system to come about without what is, I think, the most difficult part of third-party politics in the United States, and that is that minor parties can act as spoilers in campaigns. I'm sorry. Minor parties can act as spoilers where voters then get have excruciating choices about, well, do I want to vote for the person that I like the best? But I know that if I, by doing that, I might actually help elect the person that I like the least. And I think there, you want to have, it seems to me that we want to have a system in which voters get to make the choices that they make based on their preferences of the person or of the party without, you know, having to be a kind of a dining room strategist of exactly how this will impact other candidates that they don't really want to help. So that's number one. So I think that it has a very healthy impact on our democracy. Secondly, I can say based on my own experience, it was a simple and really a natural administrative reform. Connecticut has had fusion for a very long time. And, you know, so it wasn't like, well, how are we going to administer this? You basically got nominated by the campaigns. They counted the votes just as you would count the votes for any candidate. And if a candidate was endorsed by two parties, then they would add those votes together. And it was as simple as that. Believe me, when I was Secretary of State, I had complaints from the local registrars of voters, we call them in Connecticut, on many, many issues. I never had a complaint about fusion. It wasn't a problematical part of the process. And as such, there was never, and lastly, I would make the point that it was never really a costly process. There weren't additional machines that were needed. There weren't major changes in the staffing levels that were needed. It was just a very simple process of counting the votes the way you would count the votes anyway. And then if a candidate was endorsed by two parties, you add those votes. So I think there's very little in the way of fiscal implications. All this is confirmed by the research that was done by Ben Healy, who I believe is there with you at the hearing, of the Public Policy Institute of Massachusetts, and by Mariah Paul of the DEMO staff, who did a fair amount of research interviewing of election officials around the country, and essentially came up with the same conclusion that I have witnessed in my own experience. So I guess I want to end by saying that I think that House Bill 3040 is a good and a solid and a reasonable reform, which has the positive impact of expanding democratic choices and democratic engagement without any real negative in terms of cost or confusion or complication, and certainly not of the negative impact of the spoiler effect that we have seen in all too many races around the country. So I would encourage the committee, Madam Chair, to seriously consider this, and we certainly support it as both as the DEMOS policy and based on my own personal experience.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, are there any questions? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rappaport, thank you for your testimony. In your written testimony, you do mention partisan gridlock. Can you reflect on that for us? Is there an impact with fusion voting on partisan gridlock in the legislative process?
Again, based on my own my Connecticut experience and based on what I know in New York, observing the New York is a place that's always had minor parties, both conservative parties and liberal parties. And I don't believe that it has contributed to gridlock. In some ways, what it does is it I think, adds different choices into the mix. Again, in New York, vis-a-vis the Working Families Party, for instance, they have occasionally supported Republicans, occasionally supported Democrats, but I've added a voice to the mix. So the partisan gridlock that we experience both in New York and in Connecticut is really gridlock between two parties, not based on the third-party addition.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard several people testify to the fact that it increases voter turnout. I'm wondering if you could tell me how voter turnout compares to those states that do not have fusion, or at least those jurisdictions that don't. How much does it increase?
I don't know. I don't want to overspeak and say that I don't think we studied that carefully enough to give you a good response. And I don't think that the principal value of fusion voting is in higher turnout. The way, for instance, we at DEMOS are strong supporters of Election Day voter registration. I know another issue that the legislature in Oregon is considering. That, I think, in the case of Election Day registration, I think the principal reason to do it is because it increases turnout by increasing the ability of voters to get into the process and actually cast a vote. I think the principal benefit of fusion voting is more in the level of choices that voters are likely to have. You can make the case, I think, that at least at the margins, at a modest level, a person who might not have wanted to vote in a race because they have an antipathy towards one or both of the parties might be willing to go to the polls and vote for a candidate that they like on a third-party ticket. So I don't know that there's an appreciable major difference in turnout based on states that do have fusion that don't. But you clearly have an opportunity with fusion for, an energetic third party to go out and recruit new voters who might not be turned on or excited by the choices that they've had in the two-party system.
Thank you. And Representative Roplin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My would be a follow-up on that. Have they done any surveys on voter satisfaction in those states that have fusion voting as opposed to those that don't with regard to that idea that they did have a voice?
There's no question I'll draw my Connecticut experience in answering this. There were a lot of people in Connecticut who in the late 80s were sort of dissatisfied with both parties. Frankly, the Democrats, I'm a Democrat myself, but the Democrats who had been in power, sort of had a reputation in the state for being a kind of machine-oriented Democratic Party, and people were turned off by it. And by the same token, the Republicans had been in the minority and hadn't mounted a very, very strong candidate for governor for a long time. So I think the opportunity that people had at that point in time to register a third choice and do something new was unquestionably the source of satisfaction for them. The only people the only people who ever had a negative word to say about fusion, internal party strategists from both parties, where a third party creates a little bit of uncertainty and a new dynamic that you can't always trace based on, well, I've been doing this for 25 years, this is exactly how people vote in this town or in this town. But in terms of voters, I never heard any dissatisfaction. I think people really liked the fact that they had some additional choices.
Follow up.
How about with regard to what in your state you've actually had an opportunity to see before and after? Was there impact on policy with regard to that as those third parties had a voice with respect to who got elected, or did you see that at least expressed by the people elected?
It's interesting. I would say that we had in Connecticut the potential of third-party activity. We had a huge battle in Connecticut in the early 90s about the tax structure in the state. And there were kind of people who were very strongly on what you would call the conservative anti-tax side who ran some, created a third, actually I guess a fourth party, and ran some candidates, and I think that had some impact on, making some people more reluctant on the tax issue. And at the very same time, there was third-party activity on behalf of tax reform in the state, which gave some people the ability to vote on behalf of a tax structure that they might not have. So it had an interesting sort of not nullifying effect, but it had the effect of strengthening the voices on both sides of the debate, and I think that that made some people nervous and it made some people more secure. It widened the choices that they had.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much for making yourself available and adding your insight to the hearing.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be helpful. And I would just say that, is Ben there, by the way?
Yes, she is here.
He looks wonderful, too.
Love the suit.
You could go on. You could have gone online.
Did he testify yet?
Yes, he already did testify.
All right. Well, I didn't hear him, but I'm sure I agree with everything he said.
Great. We will definitely take that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We do actually have another witness who traveled from more than 100 miles to be here, and so we will call her next, Nicole Williams. And Mr. Lindbeck, would you like to come up too, or did you want to? Okay. Good morning.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Williams. I'm the Clatsop County Clerk, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks today. The Oregon Association of County Clerks has many of the same concerns for this proposal as we expressed for instant runoff voting. It is our contention that when you complicate a system, the system is more likely to fail. Both fusion voting and instant runoff voting not only change the way we vote, but it does complicate the way we vote. And I am not sure that one can work with the other, but I'll address that in a minute. Unlike the instant runoff voting proposal, House Bill 3040 does not make it an option for jurisdictions to implement. Therefore, counties will bear the cost of this change, and there will be costs. The legislation requires that all partisan candidates for a nominated position be elected in this manner at the general election. The primary concern to election officials is the enormous possibility that a voter will overvote their ballot because they will see the candidate's name listed twice for a race and will fill in the oval for that candidate names for both of the same candidates listed twice. I have had the opportunity to meet with the proponents of this House bill, and I have reviewed the paper from Demos regarding fusion voting. I wanted to point out that all the states cited in this report conduct their elections at the polls. And when you conduct your elections at the polls, when a voter brings in their ballot and it is overvoted, they have the opportunity to correct that. The poll worker actually will point out to that voter that they overvoted their ballot. Our current machines will attempt to count these overvotes and reject these ballots for further inspection. We need to have our machines programmed to catch overvotes for all the other nonpartisan races and measures on the ballot, and we have current procedures in place to inspect overvotes. I have prepared for the committee today copies of our current election ballots in which we see several overvotes during every election from voters. The increased number of double voting will delay the counting of ballots. This bill requires that if a voter does double vote, that the election official will manually tally the results for a separate candidate, and the duplicate votes will count towards a candidate without party affiliation. So we would have three tallies for a candidate. One tally for the candidate from the major nomination, party nomination, one tally for the candidate for the minor party nomination, and then a third tally for the candidate that voted for both candidates without the party. And this would be just in a separate category without the party nomination. Since we do not have tally systems in place to accommodate fusion voting, this count will need to be done by hand. This will require us to look at every overvoted ballot, segregate out the races where fusion voting may apply, and hand count these ballots. We will need to add an additional field to our election reports where the hand-counted results can be entered. Since this would take place during a general election, election results for these contests will be delayed up to several days after the election. Finally, can instant runoff voting work with fusion voting? Representative Thatcher, thank you for raising this issue. Let's think about it. A voter may be presented with a ballot with four candidates. Two of these candidates are the same person. Under this scenario, a voter may be asked to rank candidates in order of preference and also be asked to rank the same candidates differently for instant runoff voting to work properly. At the end, election officials will need to make sure that the vote for the like candidates count. However, under instant runoff voting, the vote may need to be redistributed to the other candidates. This is why the Oregon County Clerks respectfully ask this committee to oppose House Bill 3040. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I wanted to address two issues for you with respect to this bill. One of them is that this moving to a fusion voting system fundamentally changes the assumption that voters make now in Oregon in regards to party membership when they look at a ballot. Right now, when a voter looks at a ballot in Oregon and they see your name and they see a party behind it, the assumption they make is that you are a member of that party. Fusion voting changes that assumption, and that's something that would require some voter education, because they can't assume anymore that you're a member of that party. What they can assume is that you're endorsed by that party in some way. And so it may raise a question in the mind of some voters as to what is this person's true party membership, because you can't tell that anymore. I think that's something that you may want to think about in regards to a policy change of this kind. And I was thinking about an unusual situation that we have here in Oregon that this bill would affect. And I pointed this out to the advocates, and we've had some good meetings with them and productive meetings with the local advocates. And I pointed out that situation where we have in Oregon, where we have a group of legislative districts that are very heavily dominated by one party or another. Obviously, in eastern Oregon, we have some very Republican-dominated districts. In the center of Portland, we have some very Democrat-dominated districts. If this was in effect in this, under current law, what has happened is that in some of those districts, the minority party, Republican or Democrat, put up either token or no opposition in some of these legislative races. And when they put up no opposition, sometimes it provides the opportunity under current Oregon law for the candidate in the majority party to get the nomination of the other party through write-in votes of friends and acquaintances who will provide enough write-in votes so you also capture that party nomination. But under our current law, you pick which party you're going to, under that situation, is going to be behind your name on the ballot. And so if this was changed, for example, Representative Rosenbaum, in your district in Portland, if you were to get both nominations, the ballot would say Representative Diane Rosenbaum, Democrat, and Representative Diane Rosenbaum, Republican. And what does that tell the voters about what you really are? And so I think this is something that's worthy of discussion, because this is, to me, a very basic, fundamental change in what you tell the voters on the ballot. And ballots, you know, historically, you have a value that a ballot is the one place that the voter looks at in an election where what they read is accurate and true. And so I think something would have to be done about that situation, or at least you may want to consider it. And obviously there would be a need for some voter education at that point. I also want to bring some reality to the conversation here about our voting machines and give you a quick little primer on voting machines and why the testimony of Mr. Healy was just terribly inaccurate in regards to costs. Connecticut and New York, as Nicole pointed out, vote at the precinct. When you vote at the precinct elsewhere in America, you use what is called a precinct counter to vote. That is a slow in Connecticut, they are Diebold machines. They're slow speed scanners. It's an optical scan ballot that looks very similar to what we vote on here. But when the voter goes to the polling place, they put their ballot through the machine, and the scanner reads it, and it drops down into a box below. I talked to the administrator from Connecticut, and they do, and Diebold does have software for optical scan precinct counters that works in Connecticut to accommodate fusion voting. We have no Diebold machines in Oregon. We don't use precinct counters. In Oregon, we use central count machines And those are high-speed scanners. And what that means is it's the same type of optical scan ballot, but they're capable of processing ballots at a much higher speed, and they're counted in a central environment. So all of your machines, all your ballots are returned to the county in Oregon, and they're run through these high-speed counters. That's not what they use in Connecticut. And our machines that are used by our counties are manufactured by ES&S. More than 30 counties use those. Other counties use machines that are manufactured by a company called Sequoia Voting Systems. And neither of those companies have software that accommodates the counting of ballots for a fusion voting system, which means we would have to, if this was adopted, have some lead time here in order for the companies to develop the software and some money for the counties to buy it. Just because it operates in Connecticut doesn't mean it's free in Oregon, which is the sort of leap of conclusion made by by Mr. Healy, that if he had talked to us in advance prior to his testimony, we would have tried to talk to him about these matters. And let me give you one more issue in regards to this. And I'm not saying it can't be done. It can be done. But you need lead time and you need money in order to do it. Any change in any voting system has to go through both federal and state certification. Since this is brand new software that would have to be developed for our machines that we use here in Oregon, it has to go through the new federal certification system at the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. That can take, it's not unusual for that to take a year. They go through independent testing authorities like Wiley Labs, extensive testing. Then our law requires them to come here for Oregon certification because we test these systems for things that the national labs don't necessarily test for. Our process is more timely than the federal process, but they cannot come through Oregon's testing until they have completed their federal testing. That has to happen first. This is all a way of telling you that the lack of an effective date in this bill is a real problem. We would need lead time to get this done. I would suggest 4 years would be probably the most reasonable. 2 years would be a push. But something needs to be in there, because right now the way this is written, it would have an effective date immediately if it passed in this condition, and we would be hand-counting our entire 2008 elections, because there would be no other way to do this other than hand counts. So that's the reality of the situation for Oregon, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions for these witnesses, Vice Chair Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for your testimony. There are some assumptions in play, I think, with some of the comments. One is the assumption of severe overvoting, which the evidence I don't see evidence that that's happened in other states. The other is concerning instant runoff voting, again, being for nonpartisan elections. And a county would have to make a choice whether it wanted to both instant runoff if fusion was definitely in place as well. But I guess my question is, kind of a simple one, if there was a, say in my district, if there was a Democratic candidate named Peter Buckley and there was a Green Party candidate named Peter Buckley, we both had the same name, and there was a Republican candidate named Arne Roblin, couldn't the machines count the votes for the Green Party candidate named Peter Buckley and the Democrat candidate named Peter Buckley? And wouldn't that come out of the machine saying the Democrat candidate, Peter Buckley, received 80% of the vote? And the... you see where I'm going with that? I mean,
yeah.
Would not the machine count those votes?
Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Buckley, yes, it would. The problem with the machines would be when it's an overvote. So...
If I could add one more thing, and I believe this bill, though, requires, or there's some amendments, maybe, because we've talked about this with the advocates, that they want the machines to, here's the programming problem. Right now, if we have an overvote where somebody came in and voted, for example, Representative Berger in your race for both you and your opponent, just a mistake, that vote isn't counted. But the machine is programmed to the machine is programmed to say, you know, it's essentially not a vote because it doesn't know who they're really meant to vote for. But under a fusion voting system, people could, under this bill, overvote by coloring the circles for both you and if you were on a minor party, and doing it both because they're so enthusiastic about you. The machine is supposed to be programmed to accept that overvote but reject the other overvote that I was talking about. And that's complicated programming. That's why this would take new programming, new software that would need to be certified at both the federal and the state level. It also needs to, under the proposal we talked about with the advocates, is count up the votes for Representative Berger, Republican, Representative Berger, whatever minor party endorsed you, and then account for those people that overvoted in some way, and that's a third category. And those reports would need to be produced by the machines. And I'm not saying it can't be done. It can be done. Obviously, Diebold has done it in Connecticut. It's just not free, and it takes time.
Okay, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess Representative
you wanted
Buckley.
To correct the record on that 80%.
No, I was fine with that vote. I was concerned, though, which caucus you would go to. You or both. Okay, anyway. The question, I guess, goes back to, as you see this bill written, it doesn't allow you just to let the votes go through. I mean, doesn't when the overvote happens, it kicks that ballot out so you can actually look at it. So if that's happening, you're saying this bill doesn't allow you to just do those by hand and keep the other three votes together, and then at the end you just add them up separately, not in the machine. And you don't think this, the way it's written now, would do that. You think it has to be reprogrammed to do that.
Well, it depends on how efficiently you want your election to run. I mean, presumably in Connecticut they have programmed these machines so that it takes care of all of that and you eliminate all that hand counting. Yeah.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah. Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Lindbeck, you know how deeply I resent the fact that you're telling me a policy is bad because of technology. And I know that the bottom line is cost. Okay, so these wonderful machines that we have and the software that runs them, are they in, I mean, somewhere in my gut, this testimony bothers me a lot, not because it isn't true or a reality, but because why isn't this company that we are dealing with or some other company developing this software, or are they? And have we come to the point where, you know, the technology drives things, not our policy? I guess I have to put this on the record.
Okay, well, thank you. I don't think I said this policy is bad. That did not.
You said it was unworkable because of technological reasons, and that's what just gets. I guess I'm too old to let technology rule my life that completely.
Well, what I recall saying is that it can be done. It just takes time and it takes some money.
Okay, thank you. I've put on the record my feelings here.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is now I'm back to the Oregon questions I was going to ask the first panel. How many parties do we have here in Oregon, and how easy is it to form a party?
Well, I believe we have six now. The two major parties and four minor at my last count. And I'd have to look at the requirements they turn in petitions. It's done by petitioning in order to form a party. And it's a fairly hefty requirement. I'd have to look for your Representative Thatcher for the number of signatures. And then they have requirements for maintaining their status as a party.
Follow up. Would you anticipate that there would be an attempted proliferation at more third parties if this were to become reality? Like if I wanted to, well, just go ahead with that question as is.
I don't know, possibly. I mean, if what the advocates say is true is that, you know, that the current dynamics of the political system have suppressed people's interest in voting for third parties because of this perceived spoiler effect. If you eliminate that, if what they say is true and you eliminate that, it could certainly increase the number of, you know, the incentive to form a minor party.
I guess one more question.
Okay, and we're rapidly running out of time here, so please.
I think it's a pretty straightforward question. Are you saying that instead of having, because you gave the example of Chair Rosenbaum being nominated by both the Republican and the Democrat Party, mm-hmm. are you saying that if one wanted the endorsement of a third party or another party, just to simply list it as an endorsement rather than, is that what you're saying is a better option?
Well, I'm not making a judgment, I guess, on what's good or bad. I'm just trying to point this out to you so that you have policy discussions and are aware of what the issues are. The ballot is generally looked at as a document in which the administrators of elections and state law look at it as a place where it represents accuracy. You listen to all that stuff going on in the election and all the ads and all that kind of stuff, but when you get to that ballot, people want to trust that what they read on the ballot is true. And so to the extent that this may cause some confusion as to what party someone really belongs to, I just wanted to point that out to you. I think it could.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll call Anna Galland, Barbara Dudley, and Richard Burke, and then also Janice Thompson, if you could be ready after that.
Madam Chair Weathergate, if I could just comment, I think that in my district, if I ran as both a Democrat and a Republican, the undervote would be overwhelming.
Good morning, and please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, for holding this hearing, and to all of you for giving us this opportunity to testify about fusion voting. My name is Barbara Dudley. I'm an adjunct professor at the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State. I'm also a partner in Bethel Heights Vineyard, which is a family farm in Polk County. And I am a member of the Oregon Working Families Party, which is one of the advocates of this fusion legislation. Fusion, as you know, was legal in Oregon in the 19th century. And at that time, it provided a way for rural and urban voters to come together on issues which they shared in common, populist issues of the day, which affected family farmers and wage earners alike. This is an era when we could very much use that same common voice, when rural and urban Oregonians need to come together on a number of issues that plague the state, from land use planning to health care reform. We realize that fusion voting is not the solution to all of the problems that ails the state, but it's part of the solution. We believe that with fusion ballots, voters can focus on the issues which unite them, voters can vote with the party which best represents their views while making coalitions with other voters in other parties to support a particular candidate. That way, voters can make their views known, and the candidates and the legislators can have a more accurate view of what their constituents want and expect. The people of this state do not all fit neatly into one of the two major parties. Over 25% of the voters in this state who are registered to vote are not affiliated with either major party. And only 67% of the voting age population is registered to vote at all. Oregonians can be very thoughtful, they can have lots of opinions, and yet under the current system they can only participate in the electoral system in a consequential way if they vote Republican or Democrat. As you all were talking earlier about not wanting to reward non-voters, I can only say amen. But I would also like to say that we do not want to leave it there. We would like to encourage those people to vote. And we believe that fusion voting moves us in that direction. Many Oregonians clearly want more choices than they see on the ballot, but they don't want to throw their votes away. Fusion gives them the opportunity, while focusing their attention and that of the legislators whom they elect on the issues which matter most to them. Not all minor parties will exercise the option to fuse with a major party candidate. Some will continue to run standalone candidates. But again, the fusion option means the possibility of compromise and coalition is available. And that option makes it more likely that compromise could be reached in the legislature. This committee is considering many different changes to election rules. And I want to say in response to the testimony of Mr. Lindbeck and of the county clerks that we have been trying to work with the elections office, with the Secretary of State's office, and with the county clerks to reach whatever compromises will make this easier to implement. There is an amendment before you which reflects already an effort in that direction, which may not have gone in the direction this testimony just went. We understood from the Secretary of State's office that there was a problem with the possible overvotes in terms of where that vote would be, to which party would that vote be credited. And the original draft from Ledge Council said that that vote would be credited to the minor party, I believe, or to no party. We agreed that it could be credited to the major party. We actually believe that problem is going to be so small that if it answers the software issue, I would say that vote could not be counted at all, as is true, apparently, from what I just understood, with votes that are overvotes that choose two different candidates. So in other words, what I'm saying is if you have a candidate appearing twice on the ballot and somebody marks them in both places, we're open to any solution to that problem because we think it will be minor. So if it means that vote's not counted at all for the candidate, if that means it's voted for the candidate for no party, if it means it's counted for the major party and the candidate, whatever works best with the current software is perfectly fine because our experience in other states is this is a small problem. We realize there is going to be a need to change the software that we have, and we realize that will take time. Again, we are more than happy to be accommodating in that regard. But we do believe, to get back to the major point about why we think fusion voting is important, is that we think that this is one very significant way to engage voters in the election process, to increase civic engagement, as we teach it at Portland State. Here in Oregon, one proposal that's been presented to deal with questions of voter alienation and partisanship is to have a nonpartisan state legislature. The problem with nonpartisan elections is that the voters then have almost nothing to go by when deciding whom to vote for. Party affiliations give information to the voter about the stances a candidate will take on certain issues. Fusion voting allows the voter to express their opinion on issues through their choice of party and also to form coalitions with other parties on the issues of the day. just to repeat myself and then I will close, voters want more options. They want to participate constructively in the political process. They want their views and opinions to be acknowledged and taken into account. Fusion voting provides a responsible and constructive solution to this need. So with that, I would very much urge you to vote yes on House Bill 3040. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is Richard Burke. I'm here as Executive Director of the Oregon Libertarian Party. I've been active in the Libertarian Party for 16 years, and I've run a lot of the campaigns that we have run, that some of which have arguably had an impact on the outcome of various elections. And I also worked on a fusion bill last year, which made it through the Oregon House, passed overwhelmingly, and we ran out of time in the Senate. So I have a little bit of experience on this, and because so many people are testifying on various aspects, I wanted to take a look at some of the objections that are raised by some of the internal party strategists. I've come across a document here, a document there, and you know, I know they're circulating around, so I wanted to deal with them rather directly. First of all, one objection is that fusion is popular with, in one document, lefty groups. On another document, it says righty groups. And, you know, it's really interesting, and here we are. You know, libertarians are hardly seen as leftists. And this is something that we've worked on, you know, for a very long time. And, of course, you know, my friend Barbara here, you know, could hardly be seen as a right-wing type person. So this just is not true. The irony is that fusion is also popular with Republicans and Democrats. You've already heard testimony that if one major party does not run a candidate, that the other one seeks that nomination. Now, in Oregon, they have to pick which party label they want to go by. But clearly, those candidates love fusion voting because they can have it. So, you know, this is popular all around. The next objection is that fusion lets third parties have their cake and eat it too, since they don't have to field a candidate of their own, but could support a major party candidate, more or less just ride on the coattails. Well, first of all, I'll tell you that third parties, when they find that they have a strong candidate, they're going to run that candidate. If they think that they have somebody that's got a chance to win or seriously have an impact on policy, they're going to run it. You know, they're not looking, gosh, we're a third party, we don't want to run any candidates, so let's run theirs. You know, that's not what this is about. This is a way for us to, for all parties, to come together around good candidates. And we have too much partisanship today. We hear that from everyone. This allows parties to cross lines and come together behind good people. Now, as has been pointed out, any Republican or Democrat who agrees with this objection can simply refuse to accept the minor party's nomination. Why should a strategist make that decision for all of you? It just doesn't make sense to me. And this being the case, major parties benefit just as much and maybe even more than minor parties. I'll tell you, as a libertarian, as executive director, every election I am approached by Republicans and Democrats running for office begging me not to run candidates in this race or to run candidates in that race, you know, as if I had a magic wand and I could decide all of these things. You know, but and I know the Greens are also approached. But right now, let's say there's a candidate we really like, candidate Joe Blow, and they say, well, we'd love to have your cross nomination. Or say, boy, gosh, we'd love to. But you guys killed the fusion bill. We can't even talk about it. It's not even an option. So the best we can do is maybe not run a candidate, you know, which creates problems among a party's rank and file, or you know, it removes an option. Republicans and Democrats also benefit from this. They have the ability to come to us, or we to them, or them to each other. And this is a bridge-building opportunity that people can take advantage of. Which leads me to the next objection that I have read about, that fusion voting institutionalizes partisan thinking. I think this must only happen among strategists. You know, because on the contrary, the fact that candidates are seeking the nomination of other parties is itself something that undermines institutionalized partisan thinking. You know, I remember at our convention back in 2002, Representatives from the Republican gubernatorial candidate came and asked us to cross-nominate. Again, you know, we probably wouldn't have done it in that particular case, but it wasn't even an option to us. And by bringing people together around good candidates who have earned the trust of more than one party, we can undermine some of this blind partisan thinking that sometimes people fall into. And I think that's a good thing for Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, everybody. And that leads me to the next objection I've heard about. Fusion allows parties to hold out for concessions from major party candidates. Well, you know, this represents a change from the system now. You know, right now, you know, one time a candidate came to us and said, you know, you ought to think about a cabinet position. You know, who would you like to have on the cabinet? You know, I'm not going to go into the specifics of this, but right now, the question of run or not to run, you know, sometimes gives us a little bit of leverage. You know, sometimes somebody says, I won my seat by 100 votes. Are you going to run against me next time? Well, I don't know. You know, it depends on how you vote on a bunch of bills, whether, you know, our party's happy with you or not. So, you know, will there be chucking and jiving? Sure. But that's always going to happen. That's what politics is. And you all know that. This is a good bill, but the main reason it gives, the main reason why this is a good bill should pass, is because everyone gets more choices, but nobody's forced to do anything. Minor parties have more choices. We can run a candidate, as we do now, or we can offer our nomination to another party's candidate. We don't have to. Major parties have more choices, too. They can simply run, as they do now. They can seek the nomination of another party, or if one is offered to them, they can decide whether or not to accept it. Again, more choices for major parties, not forced to do anything. And the voters have more choices. They can vote for candidates as they do now, you know, not crossing any party lines, or they can signal sentiments to their candidates by voting for them on another party's ballot line. What are those sentiments? Who knows? It's going to depend on the dynamics, the issues, and the personalities involved. So a couple of other things, as I close here. The county clerk testimony bothered me a little bit. I ran into this last time when the fusion bill was up before. And, you know, no balloting system is perfect, but fusion voting hasn't resulted in, you know, electoral disarray in any of the states where it's been tried. And I refuse to believe that Oregon voters are any less intelligent than those in New York. I mean, where's the motherlode of humor we could extract from that one, you know? But, you know, and with regard to Mr. Lindback, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Lindback. He works very hard, and he has to take a lot of hits from a lot of people in his job. And I know that there are hurdles with the software, but, you know, that's not a fatal hurdle. I think that's pretty clear. And as a former computer network consultant and programmer of 18 years, this isn't hard stuff. And I've done some computer programs in the field of election finances as recently as last year, and this is not a killer objection. So anyway, you know, you don't have a lot of opportunities to pass bills that give everyone choices while not forcing anybody to do anything, especially bills that don't cost a lot of money, reduce, you know, bickering partisanship, and, you know, provide opportunities for bridge building in every conceivable direction. So, you know, I'm hoping that you'll take a look at this and take a look at the big pluses and the little teeny minuses and decide to pass this and pass it with great enthusiasm. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Chairwoman Rosenbaum and committee members, thank you so much for holding this hearing and for providing the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3040. Am I too close to the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Anna Galland. I'm actually a constituent of Representative Rosenbaum's in Portland. My particular area of expertise is young voters. That's why I'm here today. I don't know much about Libertarian Party politics. I don't know much about Green Party politics. My expertise is in registering and turning out young voters in the state of Oregon. In 2004, I was director of a program called the Young Voter Project. We had face-to-face conversations with over 70,000 18 to 34-year-olds in the state of Oregon, getting them to make sure they were registered and pledged to turn out to vote. In 2006, between 2004 and 2006, I started and then directed a program called Building Votes, which was housed by the Oregon Bus Project. We received national recognition and grant support from the Pew Charitable Trusts. We were one of eight programs nationally to get a big grant support from the Pew Charitable Trusts to run our program. And given that support, we registered over 20,000 young people to vote in 2006 and then did an intensive turnout program. So to that end, we talked to a lot more than 20,000 young people face-to-face because you have to talk to a lot of people to actually register those folks. This was one of the largest voter registration programs in the country. I have a lot of experience talking to young people in Oregon and overseeing programs to motivate those young people in Oregon. That's where I'm coming from. Again, between these two experiences, I've overseen programs that have had face-to-face contact with over 200,000 young Oregonians. That's a lot of conversations about politics. That's a lot of conversations about apathy and about why the system isn't working for me and why I don't participate as a general rule. And that's why I feel like I have some confidence in saying that here in Oregon, we do have a young voter challenge on our hands. Oregon, we know, has the nation's highest gap between young voter participation and older voter participation. This is something you may have heard about already know from the discussions about other electoral reforms, including same-day voter registration. I think this is in part a result of our success in implementing things like vote by mail, which does encourage voter participation among voters who are stable, have stamps, have an address that they've been at for a while, and know to check their mail for their ballot. But younger voters in this state are all too often alienated and disengaged from the political process. In my experience, we are always working to counter the sort of perception and actuality of disengagement and apathy. We brag as a state about the inclusiveness of vote by mail, but in the realm of young voters, I think we have a long ways to go to structurally engage young voters to participate and give them structural opportunities to be excited and passionate about voting and elections. So what keeps young voters from participating in an actual way? In my experience, a lot of things. Campaigns and candidates ignore young voters because of the sort of chicken and egg problem of low voter turnout. I'd be curious to know how many of your campaigns actually specifically targeted young voters when you went out. Maybe you did, and that would be great. There's a lack of education about the political process. Young people move so frequently that voter registration drives and our faithful county elections offices just can't find them. But vitally importantly, there's a disconnect from partisanship, there's a distrust of the system, and there's a prevailing sense that young people's voices just don't matter, that one vote, it's a small thing. Who cares? The man doesn't pay attention to me anyway. Right? So let me just emphasize that last point. Young people don't believe they can actually influence politics with their one single vote. They don't trust the parties, and they want more choice and more power with their ballot. So why would fusion, given all that background, why would fusion be part of the solution, in my opinion? Because this is a generation, my generation, generations younger than me, is a generation of communicators. If any of you have someone under 30 in your household, you know they're constantly sending text messages and MySpace messages and Facebook messages and YouTube videos and whatever. We like to communicate. We like to send messages. Fusion gives young people the power to send a message with their vote. So that's something that I think is powerful both in speaking to young people just from the state legislature saying we believe in your power to send the message with your vote, but it also gives organizers, like me, the ability to go out there and say, you want to make a difference? Yeah, vote, because look, you can even choose which line you vote on. You can send a message both with who you vote for and how you vote for them. That's a new powerful tool in our arsenal as organizers. Survey data from Fusion Legal States, we also know, has demonstrated that fusion-based parties have special appeal to young voters with limited partisan identification because fusion gives them an opportunity to both cast an expressive vote, one that reflects their issue-based priorities, and also support a major party candidate. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who understand the spoiler problem from the year 2000 if they were a progressive young voter or other years. So this provides an opportunity for disengaged youth to get involved in the process in a constructive fashion.
Anna, sorry to interrupt you, but we're going to have to ask you to wrap it up because we do have a floor session starting right away.
So. Okay. Fusion rules. Fusion rocks. young people are the political canary in the coal mine, and I think if they check out from politics, really, we're in big trouble in less than a generation. From where I stand, fusion is one vital piece of the solution. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, and I think I don't see any questions from the committee members, so thank you all for testifying. I apologize to the people who signed up but didn't get to you today. We will schedule this for another hearing and be sure that we allow plenty of time then for other people to testify too. But we do have a floor session and we're voting on some important bills today, so we need to get to that. Thank you, committee members. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3040, and we are adjourned.